difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to The Next Picture Show, a movie of the week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it's shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Tasha Robinson, here with my absolute bestest friends in the entire world.
Scott Tobias.
Keith Phipps.
And Genevieve Kosky.
God, aren't they so cute? They're totally fetch. Every week, we get together to talk over a classic film and consider how it relates to a current movie. This week, we're looking at two stories about women in power, challenged by fresh young outsiders who walk into their fiefdoms and are, like, totally nice to them to their faces, but act like super frenemies behind their backs. In one case, the future of England is on the line. In another case, the stakes are who's sitting next to who in the high school lunchroom in Evanston, Illinois. But they're still both high-tension, social competition movies about underhanded schemes and social undermining. Genevieve.
Yes?
I totally love that top. Where'd you get it?
Oh, it's my boyfriend's. I picked it up off the top of the clean laundry pile this morning.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, it looks just great on you. It's too bad our listeners can't see you right now.
Oh, thank you.
God, now if you could stop being so conceited about your clothes for just 5 minutes. God, maybe you could tell our listeners what we're doing this week.
Fine. Greek director Yorgos Lanthimos made two movies in his home country before his international breakout, 2009's Dogtooth. And none of his films since then, including The Lobster and The Killing of a Sacred Deer, have looked anything like it. That also goes for his new movie, The Favorite, a historical drama about courtiers competing for the attention and approval of Queen Anne Stuart in the early 1700s. Anne's favorite, Sarah, is played by Rachel Weisz as a snappish, bossy tyrant. But when her cousin Abigail, played by Emma Stone, arrives at the palace, she woos Queen Anne with everything from flattery to cures for gout, and in the face of her schemes, Sarah struggles to keep her position. Weisz has called the film a high-stakes Mean Girls, referring to the 2004 Mark Waters film about high school girls faking friendships with each other while jockeying for social dominance. The film also features an entrenched queen bee, Regina, and an upstart outsider, Katie, who fakes deference to her while plotting to undermine her. They're both films about backbiting and power gaming, and how women approach power struggles differently from men, and about the urge to build yourself up while tearing someone else down.
Oh my gosh, you did such a great job with that.
Oh, thanks so much.
This week, we'll look at how The Favorite and Mean Girls similarly address shifting sympathies and social competition among groups of women in two very different charged environments. And we'll look at how both films use humor and a bit of wish fulfillment to let the audience enjoy some really unpleasant behavior and a lot of open cruelty. And finally, for once, we'll get to talk about how these films use their barely there male characters as prizes and obstacles without treating them much like people. That's all coming up after this on The Next Picture Show.
Boo, you whore.
Slut.
We have a new student with us. She just moved here from Africa.
Welcome. I'm from Michigan.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Great. I'm 16, but until today, I was homeschooled. And then it was goodbye, Africa. And hello, high school.
Hi, I'm Katie.
I'm Janice.
This is Damien.
Watch out, new meat coming through.
This map shows the school's central nervous system, the cafeteria.
You got your cool Asians, burnouts, jocks, the greatest people you will ever meet, and the worst.
So you've never been to a real school before?
Shut up.
Shut up!
I didn't say anything.
Plastics.
Who are the plastics?
They're teen royalty.
That's Karen Smith.
She is one of the dumbest girls you'll ever meet.
I'm kind of psychic.
Really?
It's like I have ESPN or something.
Gretchen Wieners.
She has two Fendi purses and a silver Lexus.
And evil takes a human form in Regina George. She knows everything about everyone.
That's why her hair is so big. It's full of secrets.
We want to invite you to have lunch with us.
Regina seems sweet.
Get in, loser. We're going shopping.
Your house is really nice.
I know, right?
Being with the plastics was like leaving the actual world and entering girl world.
Have you seen any guys that you think you're cute yet?
There's this guy in my calculus class. His name's Aaron Samuels.
No. That's Regina's ex-boyfriend. Ex-boyfriends are off limits. I mean, that's just like the rules of feminism.
Gretchen told me that you like Aaron Samuels. I could talk to him for you if you want.
Really? You would do that?
You're so hot.
Why would she do that?
She's a life ruiner.
I knew how this would be settled in the animal world. But this was girl world. All the fighting had to be sneaky.
I want to lose 3 pounds.
They're these nutrition bars my mom uses to lose weight.
It won't close.
It's a 5.
You could try Sears.
Why are you eating a Caltine bar?
What?
They make you gain weight like crazy.
Who does she think she is? I, like, invented her.
I'm sorry I laughed at you.
I'm sorry I called you fat.
I'm sorry that people are so jealous of me, but I can't help it that I'm popular.
It's pretty common for novels to be adapted into narrative dramas, or for nonfiction books to be adapted into documentaries. It's rarer to see a nonfiction book adapted into a drama, but it happens from time to time, with pretty interesting results, like Susan Orlean's book The Orchid Thief, about the illicit trade in rare flowers, becoming the meta-narrative Hollywood comedy adaptation. Or Herbert Ashbery's 1928 History of New York's Underworld, becoming Martin Scorsese's outsized period drama Gangs of New York. And then there's Mean Girls, an all-star teen comedy in the Heathers mode, inspired by the sociological study and self-help guide Queen Bees and Wannabes, helping your daughter survive cliques, gossip, boyfriends, and other realities of adolescence. When parenting educator Rosalind Wiseman wrote the book in 2002, she probably wasn't thinking in terms of what it would look like as a snarky film drama, with Rachel McAdams swanning around making catty comments about her schoolmates behind their backs. But then comedian Tina Fey happened to read the book, and she saw an opportunity to address some of her own high school behavior in a movie that would both find its humor in the extremes of student bullying and take a principled stand against it. I was the mean girl. I admit it openly, Fey said in an interview with Net-a-Porter in 2015. That was a disease that had to be conquered. It's another coping mechanism. It's a bad coping mechanism. But when you feel less than, in high school, everyone feels less than everyone else for different reasons, in your mind, it's a way of leveling the playing field. Though, of course, it's not. Saying something terrible about someone else does not actually level the playing field. If I meet a girl of 14 or 15 today who is that kind of girl, I am secretly, in my body, afraid, even though I'm 45. Tina Fey's script for Mean Girls, which she enlisted her Saturday Night Live boss Lorne Michaels to produce, acknowledges all of that. The insecurity that leads to bullying, the way even adults can feel victimized by teenagers' amoral brutality, the message that making fun of someone else's weakness doesn't actually make you any stronger. But the film is also brutally funny about what that bullying looks like. It makes fun of the shallowness, dimness, and self-absorption of bullies like high school queen bees Regina, Gretchen, and Karen, played respectively by Rachel McAdams, Lacey Chabert, and Amanda Seyfried. But it also takes some pleasure in their one-liners and their unflappability. And it's not much kinder to the teenagers who are jealous of them, like best friends Janice and Damien, played by Lizzie Kaplan and Daniel Frenzes, or to the people who fall under their spell, like Katie, a homeschool kid played by Lindsay Lohan during the American Sweetheart phase of her career. When Katie enters high school for the first time, Janice and Damien help her navigate through the cliques and clans that determine high school social standing, and they claim her as one of their own. But when Regina and her group, the Plastics, take an interest in Katie, Janice sets Katie up as a spy in their midst to report on them and sabotage them. The plan falls apart a bit when Katie develops a crush on Regina's ex-boyfriend Aaron Samuels, and ends up with both a personal stake in the game and with reasons to emulate Regina as much as to destroy her. But while all of this may play out a little like a teenage version of Dangerous Liaisons by way of Heathers, it comes down to a relatively happy ending with a big morality lesson at the end. And that could be because of Tina Fey's own personal experience in the jungles of what she calls girl world, where young women attack each other with sweet smiles and kind words and hide all of their ugly reactions behind closed doors. Fey has been one of those girls, and she came out alive on the other side. She's pretty sympathetic to the insecurity they're feeling, to the short-sightedness and shallowness of youth, and to the pleasure of getting in a really good jab against an enemy, or a fake friend, or a frenemy. Whichever. It can be hard to tell the difference. And Mean Girls considers why that is, why it's harder for teenage girls to be honest about their disagreements, and how they deal with their own emotional vulnerability. It's a film that plays as funny because it's bright, heightened, and exaggerated. But it also plays as fundamentally real because it comes from a place of familiarity and honesty as well.
Oh my God, I love your bracelet. Where did you get it?
Oh, my mom made it for me. It's adorable.
So fetch. What is fetch?
Oh, it's like slang from England.
So if you're from Africa, why are you white?
Oh my God, Karen, you can't just ask people why they're white.
Okay, guys, Mean Girls. Is it or is it not totally fetch?
Jennifer, you should start this.
Oh, why should I start this? Because all right, well, that's actually a good way for me to say, like, I feel like I don't like this movie enough. Like, I feel like this is a movie that people assume I like a lot, and I like it fine. Mm-hmm. But I've actually, this is only my second or third time seeing it, but it's like just such a like cultural object at this point. I feel like I know it very well. But I didn't really go back to revisit this film a whole lot. I remember liking it when I saw it in the theater, but just the third act not working for me for a lot of reasons. I remember Regina getting hit by a bus being like one of the first moments in a film. Like, I remember actively hating, like, I hate that hit by a bus thing. And like going back and watching it this time, I notice how it's like kind of seeded throughout the film a little more, but I still like, just, I don't like that device at all. And I feel this movie maybe didn't originate it, but I think probably popularized the sudden
the Deus Ex Machina.
Yeah, it did. But specifically, someone getting like hit by a bus out of nowhere is something I feel I see way too often. Yeah.
And there's never any explanation for why a bus is doing 60 miles an hour through a crowd of students.
Yeah, like that's kind of what I was saying about how it seeds. Like you see that bus speeding by a couple times. I really wish there was a line of dialogue of someone being like, "Why is that bus driving so fast in a school zone?"
Not since Pet Sematary has a vehicular accident been set up. So I'll have
Yeah. Final Destination.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of creamed by a bus in that series.
True.
But back to Mean Girls. I mean, I like a lot about Mean Girls, and there's a lot about it that I still find funny this day. I think the first like two thirds, basically up until the Burn Book is released, I think is just incredibly smart and fun satire, you know, high school satire. And when I did see this, I was only a few years out of high school and close enough to definitely recognize in it and relate to it in a way. I'm still not really a fan of how it resolves for a variety of reasons. The, you know, the trust fall exercise in the gym just never really works for me. But, you know, I love Rachel McAdams in this. I mean, that I don't think it's too surprising to say that this is probably the moment everyone got Rachel McAdams, you know, and her performance still totally holds up. Yeah, so I wouldn't say it's totally fetch, but irregardless, it is.
Is it fetch adjacent?
Nice. Yes, it's fetch adjacent.
Irregardless, let's break it out. I think my impression at the time and really now is that it was, you know, Heather's for the masses, that had taken something that a film that was really edgy and dangerous and weird and took a lot of those edges off and made something that's a little more, maybe more relatable, but also more palatable and less distinctive.
And brought in the writer's brother to direct it.
Mark Waters instead of Daniel. Yes. Yeah. So I was never really all that. You know, the idea of these lunch table cliques is just so, it's such a cliche. Mm-hmm. But, you know, at that point it wasn't. Now it certainly is. What I like about the film is just its comic zippiness, which is just Tina Fey just running one-liners, you know, one after another. There's a lot of laughs in this film, a lot of good performances, and those are the things that really kind of keep the film going for me more than any particular insight into teenage life. I think the film's a little bit shallow in that respect.
There's a lot of proto 30 Rock stuff with Amy Poehler's character
it would be proto
Tim Meadows and things. I think about this movie, I think it's fetch enough for a while. I didn't want to be the first one to kind of like, you know, lay out criticisms of it, but I think the first two thirds are really quite good, and then the film stops cold for the writer to deliver a lecture about what the film's about, and then the rest of the movie is just an illustration of why she was right, and it just comes off as just very, you know, it comes off as very preachy and very just sort of instructional at that point, you know, and I guess it's sort of like making the medicine go down with a lot of comedic sugar, but it left a little very medicinal aftertaste to me when I first saw it and now as well.
I mean, that I think is probably, like, I haven't read the Queen Bee's book, but given that the Queen Bee's book is specifically an instruction manual for how to help your child through a bullying environment in high school, I suspect that that's where some of that is coming from.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, you cannot follow this if you're adapting that. And you earnestly want to impart some, you know, bring its lessons to the screen, you can't take this film to the dark conclusions the story kind of feels like it wants to go to, yeah. like sort of the Heather's like territory. You got to steer away from that. But I think it's, you know, maybe it's just because I'm an awful person that wants to see the darker ending. But I feel like it's a lesser film for that.
It reminds me of like a lighter, preachier version of Election. Mm. It's like a version of Election that doesn't quite have the courage of its convictions. It also reminds me of a less dark, like as you say, Heather's for the Masses. Mm-hmm. I feel like its heart is in the right place in a way that like enough of this is either relatable or just entertaining because it's so fleet, because it moved along so quickly that I mostly want to give it a pass, I guess. It doesn't speak to me in any kind of deep emotional way, and it's not going to like break any bridges, burn any barriers. I'm just in a giant.
That's a Gretchen Wieners-esque.
I'm just in a giant like metaphor mixing kick. Ever since last week, and our
sharpened bullets,
which I probably should have called out on our social media and never did. But anyway,
people sharpen bullets all the time. They make them pointier.
I'm just going to let that one go by. I've seen the House of Jack Belt way too recently to talk about sharpened bullets.
Oh my gosh.
Well, anyway, my point is just like, I almost feel like I feel more positively about this movie than what I'm hearing in this room without feeling any great need to defend it.
Yeah.
It's such a popular movie. Like, it kind of defends itself.
Yeah. Like, that's kind of what I mean about, like, I feel like I'm supposed to like it more. Like, I do like this movie. You know, I was very excited to go back and watch it and, like, and re experience it. But I think the extent to which it has become sort of a, like I said, a cultural object, and, you know, October 3rd is Mean Girls Day and Wednesdays We Wear Pink, and like just all these things that are just like part of the language of the internet now.
There's a
musical. There is a sequel.
It's so wild how these things kind of make their way through the culture. Movies that I would have dismissed or thought were no big deal at the time become these touchstones like 10 or 15 years later.
Right, so I think kind of a big deal at the time, though, I thought.
It was a hit, yeah.
It was a hit. But I think it's been elevated to a certain, like, classic status that it doesn't necessarily as a whole warrant, but the pieces of it that have kind of stuck in the cultural consciousness, I think, speak to there being something like at the heart of this movie that does resonate and is still a pleasure to go back to today.
I think with comedies in particular, there's a rolling phenomenon of if you watch a comedy at a certain time of your life and just kind of key into it, it becomes part of your childhood and it becomes something that just like echoes further and further through your consciousness. And you walk into adulthood with just like this as a cultural artifact. I can easily see seeing this at the right time of life to hugely identify with somebody in it. Mm-hmm. Like whatever side that is, like whether you're kind of getting the wish fulfillment, like wouldn't it be fun to be this pretty and popular, or wouldn't it be fun to take down the people who are pretty and popular? I could see people who got it at the right time of life, like really hanging on to this movie.
And kind of my pet theory with all high school stories is that they are made for people who are about to go into high school. Because like I think of the quintessential high school movie for me, which I frequently cite as my favorite movie, which is Clueless. Mm-hmm. And like that's a movie I saw when I was 13. Yeah, 13. And similarly, I think a lot of the people who today like really, really adore Mean Girls are just a few years younger than me and would have been like about to go into high school. So I think watching high school stories as someone who is either in high school or where high school is like way in the rear view, you aren't able to connect to it the way you are when high school is still this thing in your future.
That's an interesting point because that would have held true for me age-wise with the John Hughes films that were coming out, like 16 Candles and Breakfast Club and Pretty in Pink. These would all have been middle school experiences rather than high school experiences. Then I look at those today and like I'm thinking, he didn't know what he's talking about.
That's not what it's like to be a teenager. What was this middle-aged man thinking?
These are excerpts from a controversial future episode of the Next Picture Show.
in terms of the film's status. I mean, if you had told me at the time that I would have a podcast in the future, you told me what a podcast was, and then you said I'd be on a podcast in the future that compared a classic film to a new film, and Mean Girls was going to be the classic film. I would have been surprised to hear that.
I mean, if you told me all of those things back in 2002, I would ask you for lottery ticket numbers.
would you call this a cult classic, Mr. New Cult Cannon?
No, it's too much of a mainstream hit. Too much of a mainstream hit. But there are different modes of thought. I mean, like the original cult movies book has like the Wizard of Oz in it.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. So there are, occasions where a popular favorite has been adopted and embraced and kind of obsessed about, more than just kind of a hidden gem. So you could make the argument, I suppose, but yeah. I wouldn't necessarily unless I really needed a film. at the end of my column there, it was like, oh boy, I'm really digging deep. But let me ask you all this, Genevieve and Tasha, you were teenagers once in high school.
Just once.
Like, what does this film ring true to you anthropologically? In any way?
To a certain extent. One thing that I found interesting watching it now is how cell phones are like barely present, and just because like this movie is like right at the cusp, I think, before camera phones and everything just like totally changed how teens bully each other. Obviously, like, you know, cell phones were around and were used, but they just were used as mostly phones at this point. And they're really not present in Mean Girls at all. And that was also true of my high school experience. So I feel like this is like the same era of high school bullying or meanness that I came up in, you know, right before it like radically changed into a different kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But it's not really my personal experience. I also went to like a massive high school that had 5,000 kids in it. So like cliques weren't really even an option, you know, like you knew a fairly small percentage of the people you went to school with. So Mean Girls, I feel, is tapping into something I recognize more from high school movies than from my own high school experience. At least in sort of the anthropological sense. In terms of like how girls relate to each other, I do feel there is something true at the center of that, particularly within a certain age. Again, I think it's maybe in something that happens a little earlier than high school, at least in my own experience. But, you know.
Plenty of cruelty in high school, though.
Sure, sure. But I don't know.
I mean, I went to a super, super tiny high school where cliques also were not an option. Mm-hmm. So there's also a lot here that I can't entirely relate to. And part of that is just because so much of this movie is from the center. It's from ground zero in the like the coolest kids in school. Like, and there was no point where I was going to pass for a Rachel McAdams. There was no point where I had hair like that or lived in a giant mansion and like, you know, had my own Maserati to drive around in. So this movie feels much more to me, at least, like a fantasy of what it would be like to be centered in that world. Like what it would be like to have the school revolved around you and to be kind of fielding like that level of jealousy and competition and attack. Like I was much more, you know, the kids that are marginal in the story, the kid in the wheelchair and fat girl that calls Regina a fat ass at one point. Like that was much more likely to be me. So I'm in the same boat as sort of recognizing some of this stuff, but recognizing it more from like cultural artifacts about the artificiality of high school. Like, it feels familiar because it feels familiar from things like Heather's, as opposed to being like, oh, yeah. I mean, the insincerity of teenage girls, I think, is the main thing that this captures. Because that particular style of bullying where you're super nice to somebody and then you laugh because they believe that you were being nice or because they don't have an answer to you being super nice, that is authentically real. Mm. But the rest of it is, it's a heightened comedic version of absolutely everything.
There's another high school fantasy at work here, which is that of the new girl, of coming into a school for the first time. And in Katie's case, like, being embraced. The plastics take notice of her because she's really pretty, you know, and I think we're supposed to believe that's authentic, but also maybe coming from a place of being threatened.
you absorb and neutralize the threat, I think.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, and this kind of goes back to what I was saying about, you know, high school movies maybe being for people who haven't been through high school yet. Like, I think the fantasy of being like the new girl who, you know, becomes a queen bee is really appealing to someone who is about to enter a new school ecosystem, you know?
And not just any new girl, but the new girl with the wildly exotic past. Mm-hmm. That, again, is maybe not a fantasy that I had so much, but that I've seen reflected back at me from like so many graphic novels about being this age. Mm-hmm. Just that idea of like, we all grew up in this area together. We've known each other since kindergarten. Like, people are still calling me by the name that I had in third grade. Why can't I just like go away for 5 years and then come back as a completely new person with a new look and a cool new backstory? Like, that fantasy, I think, is the movie's kind of playing into here. Yeah. Let me ask you guys this. The movie, I think, plays differently in this environment for a lot of reasons, one of which is just high school bullying. As you say, it's completely different because of cell phones. It's also just completely different because these days we associate it with things like school shootings or, you know, with relentless Facebook bullying or Instagram bullying, with just all sorts of different things that didn't exist sociologically or technologically back then. Mm. But it also plays really differently because we know all of these people at this point, you know?
You mean the actors?
Yeah, all of the actors. Yeah. Amy Poehler's character in particular, I remember that character.
Amy Poehler,
like,
is not the person I thought you were going to bring up first in terms of people who have changed since Mean Girls.
Oh, not specifically that she's changed, okay, but that our perspective on her has changed.
Oh, I
like
see.
At the time, to me, that character was like, what is she doing in this movie? She contributes in no way to the story. Mm-hmm. These days, it's like, hey, it's Amy Poehler and she's doing a bit. This is fun. And she still doesn't contribute anything to the story, but to me, it's enjoyable to see her here.
Well, she seems like, I don't know, I actually buy that as a more realistic character than some of the others,
though. Oh, yeah.
Like the cool mom who's is way too accommodating and wants to fit in with the girls.
As we're recording this, it's just a week or so after Ariana Grande released a music video for the song Thank You Next, which recreates a bunch of kind of teen movies, including Mean Girls. And the Amy Poehler character is played briefly by Kris Jenner, which is maybe just the most inspired bit of casting in terms of Amy Poehler's character and what the 2018 analog of that would be,
yeah,
and like how she works in the Mean Girls universe. It's absolutely Kris Jenner. That is,
wow, that is more clever. Yeah.
So I'm wondering, yeah, like, what else just plays differently for you, either because we live in a different time or, you know, because you have associations with these actors at this point?
The elephant in the room is that Lindsay Lohan is a promising young actress, and she's really good in this movie. And you know, she looks bright and full of life, and she's, you know, a great comedic performer, and it didn't work out. Yeah. You know,
I held out hope for Lindsay Lohan for a long time. Like, she was, you know, top of my list of people I'm rooting for. I still love her in the Freaky Friday remake. I think that movie is actually
she's great in that.
Yeah. So going back to this point where she still like had all that promise, it's a little sad, but it's also, I think, nice to be reminded that there was something there. Rachel McAdams, I kind of called her out, like she's the star of this for me, with apologies to Lindsay Lohan, but it's also a reminder that, and people were talking about this this year with Game Night, that Rachel McAdams needs more comedic roles. It's really weird that she is so rarely cast in comedies because she's so good here. And it's like, this was right after The Notebook. So it was like these two different kinds of roles and like two different ways that her career could have gone. And it went a little more in the Notebook romantic lead direction, you know?
Yeah, but her performances became, in dramas, tend to be a lot more self-effacing. I think, yeah, when she's out there and being really aggressive, she can be very funny and striking. I mean, mm-hmm, like she is in Game Night with the Pulp Fiction moment. It's one of my favorite things to happen in movies this year, where she imitates Amanda Plummer in that. And then
has she ever hosted Saturday Night Live? With the SNL connection here, like, it seems like she should have, but I can't.
Yeah, she'd be great.
She really would.
I don't think so. I'm on her Wikipedia page now. I don't see a reference to it.
Well, while you guys are all consulting the internet, I'll also kind of give a shout out.
I'm
going to
start a petition.
Amanda Seyfried, this was her first movie. This was her first film, and she has kind of a comedic nothing of a role that I feel like was maybe cloned a little bit too much for Brittany in Glee. The person that like random crazy dumb stuff comes out of, and she doesn't have an arc. She doesn't have much of a character. We've seen her in so many movies since then, yeah, like some of which have been a lot more demanding, and it's just sort of interesting here to see her playing like a really one note, like, my only job is to sit here with my mouth open and my eyes unfocused. It's
she's
a little interesting.
Funny in it, though.
Yeah, I was gonna say she's great yeah, at it, though.
She does a good unfocus.
It's a good role.
You don't see First Reformed coming out of this performance.
Twin Peaks or Big Love or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah.
There's like, no. She definitely a much more varied career grew out of this role, but I think she's, in the limited role she has, she's good. And the whole dynamic makes sense. You know, it makes sense that each of the other two girls play around Regina. That makes sense comedically, and also just in terms of the way a tribe like that would be organized, it makes sense that they play the roles they do there. I like that performance a lot.
I also actually really enjoy Tim Meadows. Like, it's a small role. There's not a ton to it. But he gets off some pretty killer lines and moments. That business where he's just like, he's inviting everybody to come forward with their moments, and the first person to speak starts talking about tampons, and he's like, "Yeah, I can't do this. Somebody else tackle it." The moment where where Tina Fey asks, like, how many people here feel personally victimized by Regina George, and he very slowly, shamefully raises his hand.
Towards the end, you're not getting nearly as much comic business as you'd like, when she gets to go on stage and give her big speech. But you do get it from Tim Meadows. It's like, well, you really don't have to. Nobody's expecting you to go there and make a speech.
I do love that.
I think gives you some laughs where the movie really desperately needs them.
I'm speaking of Tim Meadows' character here. I'm wondering what you guys think of the adults in the film. I mean, typically movies made, like, as you say, for preteens, for kids like looking at high school as a fantasy, like, operate in this sphere where all adults are clueless and dumb. And here you have a set of adults who seem to be fairly human and pretty engaged with what everybody's thinking and feeling. They're kind of helpless in the wake of all of the things driving teenagers, but they seem well-intentioned, at least.
I think it helps that Tina Fey is really funny. They're also, that character could come off as really, well, I think she does come off as preachy, but come off as too preachy, in a really distracting way instead of a semi-distracting way.
And she's sort of a self-effacing presence. I mean, obviously Tina Fey wrote it, so she wrote her character some details that, maybe lends a little dimension to that character, like that she works at a TGI Fridays-esque restaurant, and there's a definitely sort of a sadness, applied to that character that, again, sort of counteracts the potential preachiness of a teacher character in a movie like this.
Did you guys watch the deleted scenes?
No.
Mm-mm. There's a deleted scene that I think it's really key that it was deleted, where, like, after the Mathletes win and she's congratulating them, she says something to the effect of, like, thank you guys so much for reminding me. Like, her character is divorced and not seeing anybody and unhappy and lonely. And she says something to the effect of, thank you for reminding me that not everything I touch turns to crap. And then she gets in her car and, like, the hood promptly pops off and steam pours out of it. And she's like, can I have a ride? And it's a joke that just completely deflates their victory and puts the focus back on her. And it's a very slapstick moment. And cutting it seems like kind of an acknowledgement that there's maybe a little too much, like, Tina Fey cuteness and pathos in the movie. And I think it's actually an important focusing thing.
Yeah.
Though I compare this to the adults in Clueless, who get probably less screen time but make to me a bigger impression, maybe Dan Hedaya or Wallace Shawn, and I don't know who plays his love interest in that. I think those are richer characters. I mean, certainly the relationship between the father and daughter is much stronger than the relationship between Katie and her parents, played by talented comic people, by Neil Flynn and Anna Gasteyer.
I love Dan Hedaya in that movie. And I just saw a Clueless podcast, but what an awesome relationship.
Guys, when are we going to do a Clueless podcast?
Just all Clueless all the time. I mean, we did cover Clueless on this podcast.
No, it was a movie of the week.
The Dissolve.
We did cover Clueless as a movie of the week. The Dissolve.
We did. Yeah.
Big time. It was a great week. What a publication. What a great publication we had once.
So here's the thing. As opposed to Heather's, like, the plastics here kind of seem pretty not dangerous to me. Like, Regina's full of herself, but she's not as destructive as the mean girls in other mean girls movies, effectively. And, like, Gretchen is her own worst enemy. She can't stop sabotaging herself. She's so visibly insecure. And Karen is just so dumb. I'm curious kind of what you make of the competition between them and Katie. Like, it feels a little like shooting fish in a barrel. Is there a bad guy here? Like, how bad are the plastics in this movie?
I mean, I think their badness is, like, a sort of an insinuating one. Like, I mean, Regina George in particular, like, we were doing it at the opening of this podcast with the little back and forth you wrote for us, like, it's very just like,
don't let them behind the curtain. God,
sorry.
Boo, you whore.
Boo, you whore to you too.
I just love that so much. It makes no sense.
Yeah. Actually, just going back real quick to the Tina Fey character and the, you know, little bit of preachiness of the movie as a whole through that character. Like, I do really like the point made of you have to stop calling each other sluts and whores because it makes it okay for men to call you that too. Like, I specifically remember around that era, like, women were throwing those words around as like terms of endearment more so than they do today. It still happens a little bit, but I think it's like not quite as fashionable as it was back then. And I think that Mean Girls may have actually been a part of the shift away from that, but I do really like that.
And yet the next picture show is bringing you back.
Yeah, I know. We're going to get the explicit tag. It's okay. It's okay. I can say it.
It's fine when I say it. Actually, that the it's fine when I say it kind of brings up something for me that there are little bits and pieces.
You can't just ask people why they're white.
That's one of them. The other thing is the repeated use of the word retarded. Mm-hmm. I mean, Regina keeps saying, oh my God, that's retarded. And it plays as though like it's meant to be harsh and declarative about her character like it did back then. These days, every time she said it, I flinched so hard. It's like the language of cruelty of this movie is still from another era. And mm-hmm. some of it feels way harsher today to me.
Yeah. But to go back to the question of like how mean they are, I mean, like it's they're making other people feel bad about themselves, you know, and they're doing it in a underhanded way. And I think like, yes, maybe it's not on the level of like physical violence or maybe it's not quite as traumatic, but I think that is damaging in a more insinuating way to teenagers' self-esteem, like that sort of behavior. But then again, as this movie attempts to say, like, it's also a universal behavior. It's not necessarily exclusive to the plastics. Like, that's a point the movie is making. Like, everyone kind of does this to a certain extent. The plastics are just on such a higher social level that they are able to do it to everyone. So maybe that's where the evilness comes from.
I think the movie takes on an interesting balance, though, in like implicating everybody else in creating the environment, not just the environment of gossip and backbiting and undermining and fake friending, but in the way that people emulate Regina. Like, to me, so much of this movie comes down to the scene where Janice cuts the boobs out of one of Regina's shirts in the gym locker room. Mm-hmm. Regina shrugs it off, and the next day or week, it's unclear, everybody's wearing shirts with the breasts cut out because they're all emulating her. That strikes me as actually almost a positive statement about Regina. Like, she just, somebody bullies her and she just rolls with it. Whereas everybody else in the school is trying so hard to be her that they emulate this like ridiculous looking thing. And like none of them have personalities of their own. That to me says a lot more about Tina Fey's sympathy with Regina George types than it does necessarily about how awful they are.
And that kind of cruelty sort of allows sort of be self-possessed and confident in a way that the people under her cannot be, right? I guess the phrase we have from the sporting world is the best defense is a good offense. Sometimes, I mean, that's kind of the way things work with a character like Regina George, that if you control a lot of a lot of things and you're aggressive and you're making people feel bad about themselves, or you have these petty dictates like what you can wear a certain day, what you're not allowed to wear, those acts of aggression allow you to have power and comfort and self-possession and confidence that you wouldn't have otherwise.
God, Scott, we had like a light, funny, fast-moving, fun podcast going along, and then you had to wrap it up by getting all preachy and telling us what the theme of the podcast was and giving us the moral. Fine, we'll do it your way. We'll have more to say about Mean Girls next week when we compare it to The Favorite. But first, a break and some feedback. It's time for feedback, when our listeners weigh in with their responses to recent episodes and anything else in the world of film. Scott, we got some feedback on our Lost Films episode, pairing up Orson Welles' The Other Side of the Wind with Shirkers. This one actually came in as a Facebook comment, but we thought it was an interesting take. Would you mind reading this?
Sure. Fox Bell writes, "Although there are many intentional similarities to Welles' life and the Hannaford character, I think focusing on them deflects attention away from the many ways in which Hannaford is quite unlike Welles, and in that sense, much more of a character in the tradition of monstrous men in Welles' films. He's quite similar to Mr. Arkadin, in the sense that he's a booze-swilling thug who has patches of disarming eloquence. I believe Hannaford is even described identically to Arkadin as, quote-unquote, the ogre. There's also similarities to Clay in the Immortal story, whose attempts to control a story of two young lovers proves fatal. And, of course, there's similarities between the relationships of Hannaford and his young actor and Charles Kane and Jed Leland, where a relationship that may or may not have been intimate and unspoken sputters out as a professional portrayal. Another way we see Wells playing it both ways is in his treatment of the Pauline Kael character. If this was Wells' revenge on Kael, then it is a very strange one, because she's the only person at the party who is consistently correct in her observations. She's the one who correctly surmises that the uncast role in Hannaford's film is an obvious analog for himself, setting us up for the quote-unquote voice of God scene on the set where his actor walks out. Hannaford also hits her, one of the worst moments in the film, an action Wells has never portrayed positively in any of his films. If Hannaford is Wells and Susan Strasberg is Kael, then this hardly seems like an endorsement by Wells of his own character, something I don't think he intended. Rather, I think these parallels are intended as much to beguile and confuse as be legitimately revelatory. Wells is playing with his own myth, as he always did.
I think there's a ton to unpack in there, but kind of the central part of it for me is, like, Wells denied that this character was inspired by himself. I think that the parallels we're seeing may be unintentional, that they may emerge from writing what you know and ending up with a kind of a portrait of himself that he maybe didn't intend, which may explain why he does portray somebody with so many parallels to him in such a negative manner. That said, the moment with the Pauline Kael character and him slapping her, to me, was not questioning her truth. It was trying to shut up her truth. I think it's entirely possible that he is portraying her as someone who was insightful and incisive and often accurate. But just because somebody is right doesn't necessarily mean that you like it, that you like hearing it, that you like being confronted with it, especially in such an ugly and abrasive and confrontational way as she brings these things across. It's possible that part of what he's reacting to, what Hannaford is reacting to, is the way she expresses it, both the way she outs him publicly and just her pretty extreme nastiness about it. I mean, it's possible that in some ways Wells was reacting to things Kael said about him that he maybe thought were true, but still didn't want to hear.
Yeah, I was just kind of looking up the timing on this, because Pauline Kael's book about Citizen Kane called Raising Kane was written in 1971. When did shooting begin on the other side of the wind?
71, I believe.
Right, yeah. Right around the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, I mean, it was a book Wells fans and presumably Wells were not happy about at all, because it threw a lot of credit away from him and to the writer. So I don't know if there was some animosity that was sort of brewing that kind of came spilling out on the other side of the wind. But I think the writer's point is a good one, in that, you know, the way Wells has portrayed himself or versions of himself on screen over the years is complex and not necessarily a one-to-one. And I certainly take respect the scholarship of our listener. This person has gone pretty deep into Wells' filmography, so I have to respect and kind of defer to that.
All I'd add is that at least it's not the Dirty Harry movie, The Deadpool, which I recently watched, in which a character obviously based on Pauline Kael is brutally murdered on screen in graphic detail. So
The Deadpool?
Yeah.
I don't remember that.
Not a good movie.
There's just no reason for filmmakers, I'm looking at you, M. Night Shyamalan, to stick film critics into movies just in order to murder them horribly. Come on.
That was a Kael character, of course, in Willow as well. So mm-hmm. She really, you know, made a lot of dudes mad. Which, good for her, I guess. Yeah.
We could drop in another letter here, but a lot of the feedback letters we've got right now are really, really long, and we're going to need a little time to contend with, probably on Facebook, and we're talking about potentially doing a feedback episode. So let's take a moment instead here to consider some of the other films we considered pairing with The Favorite, which is something that listeners have asked us to do from time to time. This was one of the ones we went around on a bit. We discussed this a lot.
One of the big ones is All About Eve, you know, but which particularly relationship between Rachel Weisz and Emma Stone in The Favorite mirrors the relationship between Betty Davis and Anne Baxter in that film. So that was a big one in terms of just story. But there are other films stylistically that were of interest to us as well.
Yeah, Peter Greenaway's The Draftman's Contract was a film that I believe Lanthimos has actually cited as mm-hmm. an inspiration, and certainly visually and tonally, like there's no missing the closeness between them, the parallels. It doesn't have the plot mechanics, but it does have kind of the sense of that era of like the costumes and the wigs, and it certainly has the sense of malice and of an outsider coming in and people just brutally victimizing each other. Unfortunately, Peter Greenaway's stuff can be really hard to find, and The Draftman's Contract, I think it came down to only available like for purchase on disc or some such.
All that stuff was on Filmstruck, so another reason to lament the end of Filmstruck. But a lot of Greenaway stuff you cannot find anywhere.
The Cook Thief really is really hard.
But Draftman's Contract is on Fandor. Another fine service.
There we go. Services like Filmstruck, Mubi, Fandor, like obviously we like for people to use those services. We like to encourage it. We don't necessarily want to do films where you have to have a subscription to one specific service in order to listen.
And I think with that one, it was on Fandor, but it was also like really hard to get a physical copy. Like it's out of print. So like we didn't want a movie that like if you didn't have Fandor, there was no other way for you to see it. That one came down to a practicality.
If you want to see Prospero's books, you can buy it on Amazon for like $30+.
Yeah,
on
DVD. A lot of that.
Honestly, there were times that like I did keep thinking of Prospero's books while watching The Favorite, and I kept being surprised that there wasn't text scrolling by on the screen.
It's crazy. Like, I mean, a movie like Cook Thief was an absolute sensation in art houses. I mean, people were, that was incredibly controversial at the time. I mean, people were, I know I was very anxious to run out and see it and talk about it with my friends. It was like a real thing, and for a movie like that striking to be so difficult to see now is a little bit depressing.
That one you can find, but other Greenaway stuff, I mean,
you can find Cook Thief.
Yeah, that one mm-hmm. you can track down, but good luck. Yeah, okay.
I didn't think
Belly of an Architect, Set of Two Knots.
Yeah,
good luck.
Some of those are really fun too. The other one I was thinking of to watching The Favorite would have been a movie like Kind Hearts and Coronets, which is that Ealing comedy about where Alec Guinness plays someone who's like 9 steps removed from the throne and kind of works his way up the ladder in a diabolic way. So
while playing all of the people that he's bumping off to get there.
Exactly. Really funny and would have been kind of a fun pairing as well. So there's a lot of movies that are suggested by the Favorite, which is...
Someone on Twitter also mentioned Dangerous Liaisons.
Oh, that would
certainly
be great. And I just watched that. That was my last Filmstruck movie, is watching
Dangerous Liaisons. Wait, which version did you just watch?
The Freers, and it's fantastic, absolutely fantastic. I haven't seen it in 25 years, and it holds up great, I think.
Or we could do it with Cruel Intentions, another modern
I mean, Cruel Intentions would have felt a little like doing Mean Girls in and of itself. And Lanthimos has also cited films like Possession and Cries and Whispers. There were a lot of options in this one. I think, honestly, we came down to it because Genevieve was like super enthused, which is why I'm a little surprised that you're like, yeah, but it's not Clueless.
I think it was more just like, oh, that would be fun. Like when it was like, I thought it would be fun. It was fun. We had fun, guys. I could
see pairing it with Cries and Whispers being less fun.
Yeah.
Dennis Price actually plays the murderous character in Kind Hearts and Coronets, not Alec Guinness.
Oh, yeah. It was not Alec.
Alec Guinness plays everybody else.
Oh, you're right. Okay.
Keith is back fact checking us after he disappeared for the week in which he got fact checked.
What? I didn't listen to that episode yet. What happened?
Technically, that was still my error. Keith was the one that led me there. The error. Yeah. Like he led me down the primrose path, but I followed willingly. So, and I was the one talking about how much I love John Huston for his Gandalf. So, like allowing myself to be misled is way more on me than Keith.
And since I hosted the show, I really got to rub it in Tasha's air. I got to really kind of get a lot out of that.
Wait a minute, Keith, were you secretly undermining me to tumble me from my spot as the queen bee of this podcast? Now it all comes together.
You just wait until you see how I edit all this together.
it's just going to be you saying boo, you whore, at me, like for one straight hour.
Yep.
Well, we always appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations, so we can feature your response on a future episode or post it on Facebook for discussion. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. Mm-hmm. That's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In part two, we'll jump back to the past to look at more women battling for social advantage in Yorgos Lanthimos' period piece, The Favorite. Look for that next Tuesday, or better yet, subscribe to The Next Picture Show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcatcher of choice. Find us at nextpictureshow.net, follow us at facebook.com/nextpictureshow, and follow us on Twitter at nextpicturepod, so you'll always know when a new episode drops. Until then, remember, don't have sex in the missionary position. Don't have sex standing up. Just don't do it, okay? Now we're going to mail you all some rubbers. She got the nail!